Hi, I'm Sarah.
And I'm Megan.
We're two moms with 8 kids between us, from little to grown.
We're in different areas of the country and in different stages of life.
But we both know that motherhood's a lot easier when real moms share tips and encouragement.
And remind you that it's really all going to be okay.
We're not experts. We're parents who've been there.
We're not perfect. We're real. Welcome to the Mom Hour.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 242 of the Mom Hour. I'm Sarah Powers, and I am here with Megan Francis. Hey, Megan.
Hey, Sarah.
Happy New Year, everyone.
Yes, Happy New Year. We are in it.
This is the first episode of 2020, which...
Gosh, that has such panache.
It does.
The year 2020, yes.
It's a big year. It's a big, nice round, entering a new decade. And we are starting off the year with one of our favorite things, which is to take your listener questions. We have 4 great questions that have come in that we are going to answer today. And hopefully you listened a couple weeks ago. It was the episode that aired right before Christmas. We also did listener questions. So we like to do these in pairs so that we can cover a bunch of parenting topics all at once or almost at once. But we did something a little different last week. And so we are picking up where we left off a couple of weeks ago with 4 listener questions that we are going to answer today.
And we wouldn't blame you at all if you weren't listening to our episode on Christmas or whatever. So if you want to, you can go back and listen now.
Yeah. Yeah. So it'll be a great one to catch up with. Okay. Well, we will take a quick break and then dive right into these questions.
We know that this time of year, a lot of us are making changes to our habits and focusing on our health. And for a lot of women, that means examining our relationship with alcohol. We're happy to partner with our sponsor, Lion Rock Recovery, because they have a really unique approach to substance use counseling.
Yes. So Lion Rock is all about taking the stigma out of making changes around alcohol use. So whether you want to quit entirely or just develop tools to help you moderate your use, Lion Rock is there for you. And here's the really amazing thing for moms. Lion Rock provides online substance use counseling in a virtual environment. So that lets you seek treatment from home on a flexible, family-friendly schedule.
I think most of us think of drug or alcohol treatment as something you have to go away to do, and that's just not manageable for many moms. But research actually shows that outpatient treatment like Lion Rock provides is just as effective as inpatient. And with Lion Rock, it's all done online via video conference. So not only can it work around your schedule, but you don't even have to leave your home.
That is so amazing. We know that taking the first step can be one of the hardest things, so Lion Rock has made it really easy to get started. You can schedule a free phone consultation, take a free quiz at their website, or you can live chat with one of their admissions counselors.
To make that first contact, go to lionrockrecovery.com/mom to check out a special page they created just for our listeners. And know that once you're there, everything's completely private and secure, and you can explore in a way that feels comfortable for you. Again, check it out at lionrockrecovery.com/mom. I don't know about you, Megan, but I am really ready to reset after the holidays, including paying attention to making sure my body is getting what it needs.
Weighing in from like the bloated and confused side over here. I am ready as well.
We are all in that boat right now. So not surprising, I am back to my signature morning smoothies with all that kale and acai and all that good stuff. But this year, I'm also adding a daily multivitamin from our sponsor, Ritual. They call themselves the obsessively researched vitamin for women, which I love. You take 2 easy to swallow capsules a day, and those provide 9 key nutrients that women need to support good health. I'm taking my vitamins right with my morning smoothie, and it's working great.
I love this because I know I'm not getting all the nutrition I need for my diet, no matter how hard I try. And the Ritual Essential for Women really hits those specific things that most people don't have enough of from food, like D3, omega-3, magnesium, and B12. The capsules are designed to be gentle on an empty stomach, and there's a mint tab in every bottle to keep things fresh, so you don't get that fishy aftertaste that's common with omega-3s.
Oh, yeah. We don't want fish burps in the new year. No one's here for that. I also love the pretty packaging that Ritual has and the really simple ordering. And I noticed they have a prenatal daily vitamin too. Definitely check that out if you're thinking about getting pregnant this year. And we've got a great deal for our listeners. Ritual is offering you 10% off during your first 3 months so you can fill in the gaps in your diet with the Essential for Women multivitamin. Visit ritual.com/themomhour to get started. Again, that's ritual.com/themomhour for 10% off during your first 3 months.
Okay, so our first question comes from Michelle, and it's all about handling sick days. Lots of nuances in sick days, from everything from deciding when a kid is really sick, whether you believe them when they say they're sick, what you do with them when they stay home from school, how you report it. I mean, there's a lot going on. So let's listen to Michelle's question, and then we'll jump back with our answer.
Hi, Megan and Sarah.
How do you do sick days? My oldest is a kindergartner and we're just beginning to navigate this. I felt like in preschool, if you were sick, it was not a big deal. But kindergarten, you know, the stakes are a little bit higher. And my daughter seemed, you know, sick. She had the kind of glassy look in the eye. She seemed tired, laid on the couch after we woke up. And then around 8:30 when school would be starting, lost a tooth. And all of a sudden, her mood just lifted. She was perky and upbeat. And I was kind of like, is it too late to send you to school? And on top of that, we had dance that afternoon. So because we canceled school, I told her, because you're sick, you can't go to your activity. I don't know. I'm just wondering, not just how you judge if a kid is truly sick, but what do you do to fill up your sick day? Because I don't want it to become a fun thing. I tried to limit our screen time and I tried to make sure she actually rested. But curious what your strategies are.
Okay, so Michelle, I think the first thing I want to say is that I have been there so many times with a kid whose sickness seems to fluctuate wildly depending on how motivated they are to go to school, really how they're feeling in the moment. I think that that can change. It doesn't surprise me at all that a kid would feel worse when they wake up, because when I'm sick, yeah, I feel worse right when I wake up, and then I might perk up when something exciting happens. So I think, like, there's so many things to kind of break down in this question. I think for me, the first thing would be, do you now feel like, because you've told her she has to stay home and she's sick, now that she wants to go to school, would it be the wrong thing to do to send her? And I have been a proponent my whole parenting life for the wait and see. Like, mm-hmm, I will often call the school and say, I'm going to keep him home for an hour. I'm just not sure. You might see me around 9:30. And I've done that because often that does happen. And unless they're running a fever or like coughing like crazy, it's sometimes hard to tell if they just have a little of that lingering malaise, yeah, or if they're truly sick. So I don't think there's anything wrong with that approach. And I think it would have been totally fine had you decided to send her, but you didn't. So I guess then the other question, Sarah, is then what? Right?
Yeah. No, I related to this question so much. I think she's right that in the preschool, toddler and preschool days, keeping a kid home becomes so much more about contagion management, because kids get sick so often. And it's, yeah, you know, it's really crucial that you keep those kids who've had a fever in the night or who've been vomiting or who have really green snot. Like, you have to keep them home. And I think that's most of the calls you make seem more clear somehow when the kids are really tiny. And then you do get into these elementary school ages where my kids, at least, I know all kids are different, my kids handle their colds pretty well these days. So there's a lot more gray area where maybe a kid was coughing in the night and so they didn't get great sleep and they've got that glassy eyed look, like she said, when they wake up, but they haven't had a fever. They technically slept all night. And so I feel like I've run into these, you know, subjective calls a lot more in elementary school. I will say sometimes I make it based on my own convenience. Like, if I think I'm going to send this kid to school and they're not going to make it, they're just going to be really tired and come to the nurse's office and call me, and I can't deal with that because I'm going to be running all over town, so then I just keep them home proactively for my own schedule. But then the question becomes, what do you do once they're home with you? And I appreciated that she brought up, like, not having it become super fun, especially with my kids and their relatively limited screen time. Like, that could become a real thing. Like, I know I'm going to stay home with mom and play on my iPad all day, and this is going to be great. So I do try to keep it as unfun as possible, like, not miserable, but if you're home, it's going to be kind of boring. So that's like the litmus test for me. If my kid is sick enough that they would rather be home and be bored because they really need that much rest, then it's probably a good sign they need to stay home. But I do try to say, like, if it's a gray area and I'm kind of on the fence about it, I do try to remind them, staying home's not going to be fun. I'm not available to play with you. And it's not going to be a free for all of video games. So, you know, what's your choice? Because ultimately it is still my decision, but I have tried to be kind of boring about what happens on a sick day so that it doesn't become that thing where it's super fun.
So I think I have a very different way that I handle this, interestingly, mm-hmm, although it still winds up being kind of boring.
Yeah.
I guess for me, I feel like once I've made the call, they can stay home. I also know that my kids aren't always sick when they say they don't want to go to school. Like, I'm a believer in mental health days. So I probably take a more relaxed approach to this than a lot of parents, not surprisingly. But if they do decide to stay home and I call it, again, I probably, if my kid's not contagious and lethargic and they actually could probably go to school and pull it off, and it's going to cause a bunch of inconvenience for me, then I don't. Then right. It's like, sorry, you got to go. And I can be kind of arbitrary about the way I make that decision. It might be, you know, you shouldn't have taken that day off 2 weeks ago when you seemed a little sketchy about whether you were really sick or not, because now you need to go, because now you just had an absence 2 weeks ago and you're not going to do that again unless you're really sick. So there are times I make not an arbitrary call, but it's kind of relative to what's going on around or what they've done in the past or what I have going on. But if I've decided that they have enough absences left and it's not going to cause an academic problem or be a disruption for their classroom, so that is a concern. So that's off the table. And B, they're like sick enough to stay home, right? Then I kind of just let them have a day. Like, I guess I kind of feel like then their sickness level, like I've already made the call, they get to stay home. Now, they're not going to play video games all day because I wouldn't let them do that anyway. Right. But like, I'm not going to play with them because I wouldn't do that anyway. So they have to understand I'm going to go about my day the way I would go about my day regardless. But I guess I don't intentionally do anything to restrict them because I haven't found that makes them more likely to want to do it again.
Yeah.
Like, it just, does that make sense? Like, I haven't found that they're like, oh, you know, this was an awesome day. I was like, it was a total party. I'm going to do it again. It's more like the days that they want to stay home, there genuinely is a reason that they want to stay home, whether it's because they don't want to go to school because they're super bummed out about something that happened yesterday and that's something I can't really understand, and they're kind of feigning being sick, which I think happens sometimes, or whether they really just don't feel well or they're really tired. I mean, all those things happen sometimes. Yeah. So I don't know. I guess it's kind of like what you're saying, but it's a little different in that I don't have any kind of position.
Yeah. And I think what I'm hearing is a lot of age difference too. It feels like you're talking about older elementary, middle, and high school kids.
Yeah.
And my experience has been with littler ones. And so I think there might be some of that in there too, just because the younger they are, the more you are kind of on the hook to entertain them. And that is where I have felt this slightly slippery slope of, if it feels really fun to get a home day with mom, it could be tempting to be sick a lot more often. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I get that. Well, and I think that's where the whole, like, my life has to continue regardless.
Yes.
It's almost by default not fun.
Yeah, and that's what I meant by it's going to be boring. Like, I'm not going to take my work day and do it differently. So just letting you know what it will be like. Cause I do think when my kids are younger, they picture it like summer or like, you know, we're going to go do something. That also reminds me that I wanted to mention the thing about going to dance. And we do have a loose family policy that if you're home from school, you are home from activities.
Yes.
And we've stuck to that. And that will also make kids think twice, especially if it's an activity that they really like or something else they're looking forward to. That when you're, and I think my mom did that when I was a kid too, because I, of course, wanted to go to ballet, even if I stayed home from school. And she, you know, no. Like if you're sick enough to stay home from school, then you're missing your activities too. And sometimes that has repercussions. So,
yeah. And that's definitely been something like, in our house, I would say that's 95% of the time. Maybe there's been some examples. I'm sure there have been of something that was like in the evening. And by the time it got there, I was like, you know what? I think you're well enough to go. But the policy is you're not going to go to that thing. And in fact, I kind of feel like that's an unofficial school policy or like it wouldn't even ever occur to me to send a kid to if they were too sick to go to school, it would never occur to me to send them to an activity. So that's just, you know, I'll remind them sometimes like, oh, you know, you have XYZ after school or you're supposed to get together with a friend or whatever it is. And that won't happen if you stay home. And there have been times that ended up being the deciding factor for them. But there's just so much nuance.
Have you had kids who are on the opposite side where they want to go to school and you have to say like, you are not well, my friend?
I think it's probably happened a couple of times. I remember it happening with me in fourth grade because I had perfect attendance.
Oh.
And I got to like March and got the worst, like terrible sickness. And I remember my mom just saying, I'm so sorry you can't go. And I was crying. And I feel like my kids have had a couple moments like that. Like there was something at stake.
Yeah.
And they really, like there was something special that day and they really wanted to go. But even they knew they couldn't, like it was a very weak attempt.
Yeah.
Like a day where there's a field trip or like a, some kind of fun thing going on in school. But I was like, you know, I'm sorry. No,
no, that's, it has happened with us. And it is this, like you said, it's a field trip or something. They're so disappointed to miss and you just feel awful. But
I remember sneaking out in 10th grade to go to Bye Bye Birdie rehearsal after school when I was deathly ill, like so sick. And I remember my stepmom showing up and being like, I came home and you weren't there. What are you doing? I got in, like, it was so embarrassing.
Like feverish Megan, like stumbling around trying to get to rehearsal.
It truly was. Like I had no business being there, but to me, that was like the highlight of my life at that time was like theater, like play rehearsal. So I wanted to be there and I got in big trouble for that one.
I definitely powered through, probably not fevers because that would have just knocked me out. But I remember powering through a lot of colds and, you know, laryngitis. You and I both lose our voices. And this is like later high school, but choir, dance, like shows, rehearsals. And I just feel like I was kind of sick a lot of the time. Maybe that's just my memory, but, you know, like powering through colds. And I guess the older you get, the more probably the teenagers can help make those decisions a little bit. I don't know.
Yeah,
probably.
Well, and in my house, like, it's not always easy to tell. Like, I'll have a kid who it just manifests differently, I guess. Like when they're little, they can barely breathe and like everything is running. You know, they're not probably taking meds the same way, like they're not managing their own meds. By the time I was a teenager, like I would pop a Sudafed if I needed one. And so it's just a very different relationship with the kid and their own symptoms. And you have to like learn how to trust them in a different way about how they feel. And you get to make less of the call. The call really becomes about, you know, can you afford to take this day off? Like really, can you? Because it does, the stakes do get higher, definitely in high school. And like what they're going to miss. At the same time, you don't want an infectious kid running around, like bringing off down the rest of the sophomore class. So it's very nuanced.
And that is so drilled into you when your kids are tiny about not sending kids to school who are spreading germs. And I think I've always taken that like really, really seriously. So anytime I do send a kid that's in that lingering cough phase where they are not contagious anymore, but they sound bad, I always feel like I'm doing that thing where I'm like, they're fine. Like they're really
they're fine,
not
I swear.
Sick. I swear. Yep. And I'm very, very good about it. I really don't send contagious kids to school, but I have sent kids to school who look or sound like they might be contagious. And I'm very sensitive to that judgment or perceived judgment. Two of my kids get coughs that just linger well after, you know, the virus has moved through. And so I always kind of feel like it's fine. It's fine. It's fine. So,
well, you know, the thing is that doesn't go away because there are people, right? Like I remember working my first food service job, maybe not my first, like a food service job in college. And I had to come in and I remember like saying, what? Like, you're going to make me come in? I'm so contagious and I'm going to be carrying food to people's, I remember like the, how jarring that was to go from high school when everyone was telling me, stay home, you're sick. Like you can't. And then suddenly here I am in college. And like the expectation is you're going to go on with life and it doesn't matter who you infect. And I felt awful about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I felt awful, but I also felt awful about all the people I made sick. If you went to a Steak and Shake in Kalamazoo, Michigan in February of 1995.
There's a
very good chance that I made you very ill. I'm so sorry.
Oh my gosh. That's so funny. I was just thinking about our full-time outside the home working, like two parent working families, and wanted to mention the interview you did with Colleen from the Mom Project, because she answered some great questions about the logistics of taking sick days for yourself to care for a sick child and disclosing what you're doing, all that. Because one thing we haven't mentioned here is the plight of being full time outside the home, which we have both done with small children in daycare. And that's a very different call about it's also about like, how do you get coverage for the kid who needs to stay home? You and I are, you know, we can have a full work day while the kid is over there on the couch because we work from home. But if you don't, that's like, that's a whole other thing to consider. So I will link that up. And I thought she had really smart things to say on some things I was not aware of from that perspective. So, all right. Well, we should take our next question, and it comes from Mallory. So Mallory is a mom of two under two. She has a 21-month-old and a 5-week-old, or that's how old they were when she sent this in to us. So they're a bit older now. But she has a question about accepting help from people who offer. She says, there are several people in my life who have said, let me know how I can help. Honestly, I can think of several things they can do, from playing with the toddler to cleaning the house. My only problem is I don't know how to actually reach out and accept the help. And she gives a couple of examples. She was trying to load both babies into the car and someone offered to help. And she was like, no, I got it. And then she was like, why did I say that?
Wait, no, I don't.
I don't got this. And her mother-in-law has offered to take a day off of work and come over and help. And she's hesitated to say yes, because it feels like a lot to have your mother-in-law in your house. And is it a social visit, or how do you actually put her to work? Like, what are the actual things you do to accept that help? So she says, if y'all have any thoughts on how to accept the help that is offered, I'd appreciate it. And that came from Mallory. So I thought that's a great question.
It's a great question. I think we've all been there. First of all, going from one to two is when you realize that those reflexive things you say about, I got this or whatever, you're like, wait, what? And it's almost like you have to practice a new way of answering those questions. Like, you literally have to have a different answer in your head and almost play it out, like what that would look like. So yes, that would, you know, like when you, Mallory, if you had said, sure, I would love some help, to somebody who was trying to help you get the baby and the toddler in the car. Well, then what? Like, are you going to hand off the baby car seat and then they're going to stick that in? Or are they going to take the toddler's hand and lead and walk them around? Like, it's almost like you have to play it all the way through so that you don't feel awkward, because then you don't want to be like standing there, like kind of fighting over who's going to take it. Like, I'm just picturing this, like someone grabs the baby's car seat and there's this like back and forth. So it's almost like you have to, in your head, know what in that moment would actually be helpful to you. And totally the same thing with your mother-in-law. Like, maybe it's not helpful for her to come over. Maybe it's helpful for her to take your toddler away to her house for the day. Or maybe it's helpful for her to come and you put yourself in your room and take a nap. Or maybe it's helpful for her to come hold the baby and you and your toddler go out for an outing, or vice versa. She comes and plays with the toddler and you leave with the baby. Like, there's all these different scenarios, but I think that the first step is figuring out, what do I actually need?
Yes.
And then how, like, and then what is the way to express that to the person who's offering the help? And I just think that that takes some, like, it takes some mental work on your part and then some practicing.
Yes, 100%. Yes. You can't really accept the help until you know what help you want or need. And you can't know what you want or need until you kind of check in with yourself. And when you're in the weeds with two under two, that's hard. The other thing I'll say is, I am someone who sometimes wants to come up with the perfect system or the perfect solution or the most efficient use of everyone's time. Yeah. And that can be a roadblock to just accepting some small gesture, even if it's not perfect. So the mother-in-law example, I might be tempted to, yeah, like you said, play out, okay, what do I really want? What's the most, how can I get the most done on this day of free childcare? And, you know, it might be a little awkward the first time. It might not go perfectly. The baby might cry more than you thought and you've got to take back over. I still think flexing that muscle and practicing the, if it's a genuine offer, practicing accepting it, or even half a day, and going through the other muscles you have to flex, which is being humble enough to let somebody into your home and kind of see you in that vulnerable place, saying thank you and just being okay with appreciating something, even when you're not in a position to return a favor. Those are all things that are really hard, especially as women, especially as moms. But the more we practice, the more natural they feel. And I think we've talked about this before on the show. When you accept help from somebody, it also gives them permission to ask for help. And so it kind of, it creates this spiral effect. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And I also think, like, if you go into any offer of help with, how do I get the most done with that? Like, you're probably going to be disappointed. Like,
well, that's how my brain works all the time.
I mean, and it's, you will, like, the nice happy accident is that even if you take a nap while your mother-in-law's there, you'll get more done later because you'll be rested. Or even if you just leave the house and go do something fun for yourself and the baby, or yourself and the toddler, or however it works out, the net result will still be you get more done. It just might not happen then. It might not happen in that block of time. It might not happen as a direct result from that help, that helpful gesture. So it's also cool to just decide you're going to, like, lock yourself in your room and take a bubble bath. And then who cares what your mother-in-law's doing downstairs?
Yeah.
Like, none your business at that point, you know, which I know is easier said than done.
I wanted to bring up something about paid help if it is an option, because some of us have, for some people, it's harder to ask for favors or accept favors, and it might be easier to think of something small that you can hire out or outsource. And I don't mean a full-time live-in nanny or personal assistant. I mean, when we first had our very first baby, we decided to splurge on monthly yard work, and it was like $75, and it felt like the biggest deal. But I wanted my husband inside with me helping with household and baby chores and not mowing the lawn in 100 degree Arizona heat. And it was like one little thing that just, first of all, it made us feel like grownups, like, whoa, we're like hiring somebody to do something for our house. At the time, we were really young and didn't have extra money. It felt it felt like we were taking control of the time money equation and thinking, how can we outsource something to buy us more time? So I know this question came in as accepting help that's offered as favors, but I'd also encourage you to think about if there's small ways that you can outsource something that might cost you a little bit of money, but buy you back some of this, you know, some of the overwhelm and stress that comes with having two under two. I've talked at length on this show about how bad I was about getting regular babysitting when my kids were, especially when I had my third, when I had like zero, two, and four. It stopped being possible to find like a cheap babysitter who could do it. And so I got out of the habit, and it was years before I got comfortable again. And it wasn't like I was like afraid. I just got out of the habit. And then it seemed like such a hassle and such a big deal to teach somebody how to put my three kids to bed. And I wish I'd flexed that muscle more. Honestly, I wish I'd been more in the habit of saying, you know what, I need 3 hours to myself this week, so I'm going to hire a babysitter. And that's another way of asking for and accepting help. It's just, it has a cost associated with it, but not always a high cost. So,
right. Well, and your example about yard work is great, because when there is something that needs to be done that is looming and it doesn't get done, it creates anxiety and it can create resentment. And like you said, you wanted your husband in with you because you needed help.
Yeah.
whether you got the help directly from a childcare provider or from your husband because he wasn't tied up doing something else.
Yeah.
I had a similar example with getting our garage cleaned. I remember we hired someone a long time ago before I was in the habit at all of hiring people to do anything. But otherwise, I just would have been thinking every weekend, like, well, the garage really needs to get cleaned. Mm-hmm. But do I want, you know, John to disappear into it for 7 hours? Do I want to do it? I've got a baby and a toddler. How's that going to work? Right. So, yeah. So there's all kinds of ways to add help into your life to free up other areas, even if it's not direct.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I have often admired large families like yours, Megan, and other, you know, friends who have 4 and 5 kids, because I think it makes it almost, it's like no longer up for debate. You have to call in reinforcements, whether it's mothers-in-law or paid babysitters or friends or neighbors. You're trading, you're co-oping. And so I think if we could all adopt the mindset of somebody with like 6 little kids it's not that you lower your standards, but you get over yourself a little bit. You get over this, like, do I really need the help? Is it worth it to ask? Do I deserve it? You get over all of that because you need it. Like, so
the only other option is drowning. So you're like yes.
Imagine like put yourself in that mindset of like, you have triplets and you have to have help. So now how do you accept help?
Right.
And I think that I often think we can learn a lot from those moms who are in a little bit more of an extreme circumstance for whatever reason, because, you know, again, you get over yourself faster because you just have to accept the help. So, all right. Well, we are going to go to break and come back and take 2 more listener questions.
Sarah, I'm so excited. I am moving to a new house with a bigger kitchen this month, and it's got me so motivated to cook more at home. I've had almost 0 counter space for the last couple of years, and now I'm going to be like one of those cooking show hosts that I can spread everything out, and I just can't wait.
Oh my gosh, I want to come to your new kitchen. Well, you know that our sponsor HelloFresh is going to be sending you delicious meal kits to inspire those cook-at-home meals. They have more than 22 chef-curated recipes to choose from each week, and the ones we've tried have been really delicious.
Yeah, us too. My kids love the Juicy Lucy burgers, and this winter I'm looking forward to trying the roasted vegetable paella. That sounds so like comforting and
exotic.
Exotic, but also really good for you. HelloFresh also gets that busy families need flexibility, so I love that you can add extra meals to your order or throw in some yummy sides or a lunch. And of course, you can skip a week whenever you need, and that flexibility is so great for me as a divorced mom who sometimes has like a ton of kids in my house and sometimes not at all.
Right, totally. And if you've ever wondered about the sustainability of ordering from HelloFresh, you might be surprised to know that the packaging HelloFresh uses to ship your food is almost entirely made from recyclable or already recycled content. And one study actually showed that HelloFresh's carbon footprint is 25% lower than store-bought grocery-made meals.
Wow, that's great. And I appreciate how thoughtfully the packaging is put together when the box arrives at my doorstep. HelloFresh plans are priced from just $5.66 per serving, and we've got a great deal to save you even more during HelloFresh's New Year sale. Go to HelloFresh.com/TheMomHour10 and use code TheMomHour10 for 10 free meals, including free shipping. Again, that's HelloFresh.com/TheMomHour10 and use code TheMomHour10 for 10 free meals, including free shipping during HelloFresh's New Year sale. Okay, Sarah, so I admit I've gone most of my life without thinking too hard about my deodorant.
Okay, well, that makes two of us. Yep, I'm with you.
But a few years ago, I started thinking, like, gee, how do antiperspirants actually stop you from sweating? And then I Googled it, and I discovered that many of them actually plug up your sweat glands with aluminum, and that kind of gave me pause. I mean, I don't love to sweat, and I definitely don't want to stink, but I also don't know how I feel about having chemicals all up in there, you know?
Totally, I know. I was also disturbed when I learned this a while ago, but I admit it took me a long time to consider making a switch because natural deodorants just have kind of a bad reputation for not getting the job done.
That is why we love our sponsor, Native. Native deodorant is formulated without aluminum, parabens, or talc. It's just ingredients you've heard of and might actually eat, like coconut oil and shea butter. But here's the really key part. It works.
It really does. And it smells so good. They have over 10 scents, including coconut and vanilla, lavender and rose, cucumber and mint, and eucalyptus and mint, as well as an unscented option and a baking soda free formula for sensitive skin.
I am personally in love with my lavender and rose scent. I actually kind of like to sniff myself during the day. I am not joking. You might remember I started using Native during that yoga challenge I was doing this time last year. And guess what? I'm using it this year during the same yoga challenge. Because not only does it work, but I get a delicious waft of lavender and rose armpit every time I go into Downward Dog.
I mean, it's really a gift to the yoga studio and everyone around you, let's be honest. I left my lavender and rose stick just recently at a hotel, and I need to go get a new one, like, today. I love it. Well, for all of you out there who want to try Native, there is no risk to try. They offer free shipping on every order and 30-day free returns and exchanges in the USA. And we've got a great deal for you. For 20% off your first purchase, visit nativedeodorant.com and use the promo code THEMOMHOUR20 during checkout. Again, head to nativedeodorant.com and use that code THEMOMHOUR20 during checkout for 20% off your first purchase.
Okay, our next question comes from Brady, and she said, "Hello, ladies. I was wondering if you have any wisdom about when kids get out of bed in the middle of the night saying they're scared. My six-year-old son does this often and has for about 3 years. Not every night, but maybe once or twice a month." So first of all, I'll just pause there and say that's a little different than if it were every night. Once or twice a month. Yeah, still something she wants to address. Totally
yes.
Cool, but different than nightly. In the middle of the night, he'll creep into our room saying he had a bad dream. His end game is wanting to sleep in our bed, which we don't allow due to my husband's early work schedule. So I groggily walk him back upstairs to his room, and he usually goes back to sleep without a fight. I guess I should be glad he goes back to bed relatively easily, but unfortunately, I have a really short fuse at 3 a.m.
Don't we all?
Yes.
Yes.
The only ones who don't probably are the ones who just haven't slept through the night in years. Yes. And then you're just so used to it. I have found, sidebar, that the better my kids sleep, the worse I am about getting up in the middle of the night.
Absolutely. Once you're out of that phase, it's so hard to go back. Yeah.
So she says, "It's very difficult for me to muster up comforting and reassuring words when I'm half asleep," which I totally can relate to. So how do you handle this? Any tips or tricks? Or do I just chalk it up to this being another difficult but unavoidable aspect of parenting? Thank you. Love you guys. Brady.
Yes and yes and yes. Okay. So it could be one of those difficult but unavoidable aspects of parenting. I think that I've had at least two, maybe three kids for whom the nighttime visits have persisted and been a thing to different degrees. Sometimes it's the once or twice a month. Sometimes it's couple times a week. I've had a few that it's almost nightly for a while. So first of all, I guess just to reassure, I don't think you owe your kid super comforting and reassuring words at 3 a.m. I think the fact that you're getting out of bed is more than, and like walking them to their room is more than I often could muster up the energy for, or even just the ability to do at that time of the night. When Owen, I think I wrote about this, maybe, I don't remember where I wrote about this.
Yeah,
someplace.
I've definitely read
Washington
and heard
Post
about
or something.
Owen. Yeah.
He had such a long string of those kind of nighttime wakings that I actually had like a little bed on the floor next to my bed that he could just like, he knew better than to wake. Cause for a while he would just stand next to my bed, I guess not wanting to wake me, but he would stare at me. And then, mm-hmm. you know, that feeling you get when you know someone's looking at you, and I'd wake up and be like, ah. So I told him, just don't do that anymore. If you come in my room and like, and we're asleep, just lay on the floor and go back to sleep. So we were kind of able to train him into doing that. And I knew because he wasn't getting into my bed with me and sleeping in my bed. Not to say I never let him do that, but it was really, really rare. He really was only doing it when he was truly afraid. Like, mm-hmm. I never felt manipulated by him. There's been other kids in my house that shall remain nameless who I know were just trying to get my attention.
Yeah.
Trying to get in the bed. Like, you can kind of tell the difference, I think. And how you react can be different, but I think your ability to sleep matters too. Mm-hmm. So, like, I guess I don't really know that there's one solution. I think it could be many different solutions. But like, it's okay that you don't feel super nurturing at 3 a.m.
I agree. A couple of great things I think about this situation, and I'd probably have different things to say. First of all, if it was happening every night and if the child were in real emotional distress from right. nightmares or night wakings, my advice would be a little different. So what is interesting about this case is it's not every night, and he goes to sleep on his own relatively easily, which yes. is great because I'm sure he is having a bad dream and he would love to be close to mom and dad, but he's 80% of the way there to yeah. being to having really good soothing skills. So with a 6-year-old, I have been very honest with my kids that, you know, mom and dad need our sleep, and in our house, this is when I go to my in our family, we or in our house, you know, everyone sleeps in their own bed, and, you know, we have a goal to sleep there all night. I will always help you if you need something in the night, but let's set you up with a few tools in your room so that maybe you don't even need me and we can all sleep a little bit better. And that's when you start to pull out things like, you know, give him a sequence of things that he can try in his own room before he comes to get you. And maybe it's as simple as a little nightlight that he could turn on, or we've done a lot with my younger two kids who have nighttime fears about like breathing exercises or meditation or little things you can learn. Just download the Calm app, or there's a million things you can do, but some little counting exercise or meditation exercise, a little nightlight, any little sequence of events that he feels like, I'm going to try these three things before I get mom. And then the next thing I was going to say is what you said, which is I have tried to be as boring as possible in the middle mm-hmm. of the night, which is, I don't ever want my kids to feel like they can't come to me or call for me. So I would never say you can't, but I'm going to be as uninteresting and as minimally helpful, like provide the minimum yes. amount of help and support. And of course, I am not talking about a kid in major distress here. I'm talking right. about the kid who is standing like Owen. So making a bed that they can get into, I think, is a great example of that. Like, yep, you can come be closer to me. Just, you know, you don't need to wake me up because here's your bed. I've also employed the least interesting parent. So I know later in this episode, we're going to talk about having a strong parental preference. If the preference is for me, I have sometimes said things like, you know, mom has been getting woken up a lot in the middle of the night lately. So for the next couple of nights, it's going to be dad on duty. And it's amazing how the needs just seem like, to reduce themselves yes. because mom was the one they wanted. They knew they could have a parent, a very nurturing, responsive yeah. parent, but they were like, I don't really care.
So, right. Yes. Because what they want is mom. Yeah. No, it makes yeah. so much sense.
So the bed on the floor, the least interesting parent, or sometimes it's a matter of kind of weaning the amount of involvement. So you might say, oh, I'm so sorry you had a bad dream. I'm not able to walk you back to your room right now, but I'll keep a flashlight by my bed so that you can escort yourself back. Yeah. Like, so you're meeting them halfway, but you're making it slightly inconvenient and uncomfortable for them to go through these hoops.
Right. Is it worth it for them to get out of bed?
Exactly. Exactly.
And come and visit you. And if all you're doing is grunting, like I remember doing that sort of like half-hearted, like, and like kind of patting their back and then being like, go back to bed. And really like talking very low, yeah. like just not kind of the way you would do with a baby in the middle of the night if you didn't want them to fully rouse, mm-hmm. because you also don't want to stimulate them. They might be coming to you in a very like half sleeping, like reflexive way.
Right.
They don't even really know what they're right. doing. Yeah.
And that's why I think having a couple tools or something to expect, it just might like there he's showing up because that's what he does. And you're responding in the way you always have. But, and again, I think all of this is because he's already doing a really good job. He's already showing he's not terrified in his room. He's able to go back to sleep on his own. So you're 80% of the way there. You just get to set, I think, probably, especially because he's 6 and not 2.5 or 3, you get to set some realistic boundaries that will put you back to sleeping all the way through the night without, you know, making him feel abandoned or hurt. Because it's because you're almost there, I think.
So. I think you're right. And I think that probably by the time Brady hears this, this will have been resolved. Like, my feeling is if a kid is that close, they're like almost, they're just weaning themselves off. Or maybe they're going through a little phase at night where they're, and they're coming up on a developmental milestone and they're having some sleep interruptions. And often this stuff just kind of works itself out. When it's that, when they're that old and it's that infrequent. And like you said, Sarah, they're not in super distress. It's probably already phasing out without you having to do much more.
Yeah. All right. Solved that one.
Solved. All right. Moving on. Let's see if we can have this much success with the last one. So this last question for today comes from Nat. And she says, hi, Sarah and Megan. I'm a mom of a 1-year-old son and a 3-year-old daughter in Ottawa, Canada. I have a question for Sarah. I've heard you talk about parenting a child who wants to be glued to mom. My daughter wants to be glued to dad. He loves being the favorite, but it's relentless for him. I'd like to help take the load off of him, but when mom or dad are both home, she only wants dad. It's hard for me too. I often feel like the rejected parent, and I wish I had a better connection with my daughter. Do you or your husband or a grandparent of your children have any advice on how other parental figures can connect with a child who only wants to be glued to you?
Okay, Nat, I'm going to be very honest and say this is a current struggle in my house right now. And so I am with you rather than like advising you from a lofty place. But I've never had any of my kids be as strongly preferential as my third child is toward me. And we have running jokes about it in our family. Like, we call her my tiny stalker because she'll leave me love notes everywhere. Like, I find notes. I mean, she really thinks I am the bee's knees. She prefers me at all times. Not only that, but she is not very nice to her dad a lot of the time. And it's really hard. Ouch. It's hurtful to him. And it's manipulative on her part a lot of the time. And it is, he understands that developmentally, it's very normal for kids to have a preference. But as with many things with Violet, it comes out in a, like, an ultra way. So instead of just like, oh, I want mommy to put me to bed, no big deal, it comes with this kind of harsh rejection and like a bit of a power play. And so I will just say this has not been easy for us. Brian is really, he tries really hard to know that it's normal, not to take it personally, but it's very hard on him. And it's hard on me because the expectation is I am with her at all times, which is why. And she's in full time school. She's almost 7 years old. Like, this is not a 2-year-old. So that's the first thing I will say is it's just really hard. And so I'm validating that. A couple of things that have helped for us with Violet, it never helps to be given the choice or to try to convince her to choose dad. She will always see that as an open door and not just choose me, but do it in a way that's hurtful. So it has to be a non-option or like the only option. So sometimes that's when I'm gone and I do travel for work a few times a year, or I'm out doing something. Last night, Allegra and I were recording an episode of Kid Literate, our new podcast. Unplanned plug there. So Brian took the younger two up and the only option was that he was going to put her to bed. And he said they did great. She enjoyed it. But we have had to remove the choice because that has what created the emotional dynamic. In terms of like, yeah, it is really hard. It's really hurtful. I think it helps to understand that it's normal. And I think it also can help to have, we just talked in the sleep question about being the least interesting parent. I use this strategy a lot. Like, if you want to make a fort and make believe, guess what? I'm not your parent. Like, I'm still your parent. I'm not your guy. I'm not the one that is fun. But guess what? I know somebody else who will build the entire family room into a fort and line up 200 stuffed animals and pretend with you. His name's Dad. He's great at what he does. Might I recommend? Like, and that will. So I've had to have ways where I really remove myself as an option and then empower him to his strengths to where she can't resist. Like, she can't resist like a stuffed animal fort party. But that's even that is sad. It's sad that he has to try that hard. So this has been hard for us.
Can I say, I don't think I was ever in the position of not being the favorite parent. I think that's very typical for moms who work from home or stay home because the kids get used to dad coming and going. And my kids really didn't get used to me coming and going the same way. So I was sort of the default favorite. And so that was also hard on me because it was exhausting. Yep. And I do remember like what you're talking about, Sarah, is the like creating things that only, in this case, mom can do. So I think that that's really wise to create things that only the unpreferred parent can do, which in Nat's case would be mom. So like in our case, it was things like errands. Like John was great at grabbing a kid and taking them out on an errand. Mm-hmm. And I was bad at that. Like for me, going and running an errand was all about efficiency. And the last thing I wanted was like a toddler to slow it down. John liked to have company when he shopped because he wasn't used to having the kids around him all the time. So it was just a very different dynamic. And we were able to find little ways for the parent who was non-preferred to like take over for a while. But it and they all outgrew it. It is a phase that eventually either fades or sometimes flips. Mm-hmm. I've heard about families where a kid goes from being all about dad to all about mom or vice versa. Yeah. But it is hard. It's hard. In the meantime,
it is hard. And with a 3-year-old, like she has, we're very used to offering them choices. Like, would you like the red cup or the blue cup? Like, would you like, you know, in all the parenting books, that's the way you give a preschooler kind of their feelings of agency and power, which can be a great strategy. I have not found that effective in this case because we're choosing people and there are feelings involved. And, often we're the adults, like we get to decide. I think I've shared that my sister-in-law, they've had a mom and dad take turns doing bedtime every night. And I think it's such a beautiful system if it works for your schedule, because it removes the preference or the choice. They still might have a favorite parent, but if there's a little bit of an expectation that they don't always get to choose their favorite, and the other thing that does is it gives ample practice for bonding and connection. I know Nat was asking about fostering that connection when you don't feel like you're the one who's preferred. And a lot of connection comes with time and time spent doing stuff together. So in any way that you can almost remove the choice and remove the emotionality of the choice, like, oh, yep, this is dad's turn to do this, or I'm in charge of bath time tonight, so here's how we're going to do it, and just kind of be matter of fact. And I think a 3-year-old is probably too young to understand the hurt feelings dynamic. So it's not about like, she doesn't need to feel guilty for preferring dad, but you can just be matter of fact about she's not always going to get her preference, just like you don't always get the cup, the color cup that you want. With Violet, because she's almost 7, we do sometimes have conversations about the way her words make her dad feel, because she's older. That's a different conversation than I'd have with a 3-year-old probably.
Well, and I mean, I like your idea that it's presenting something as this is just the way it is so often the solution to power struggles. Like because then it's not about, no one's making the choice. It's just how it is. You can blame it on, it's just how it is.
Yep.
It's like the universe decided this is the way things are going to be. Mom's not responsible, dad's not responsible, and you don't get to choose. Let's move on.
Right. Yes. Right. You could still choose the color of your cup, but not this one. Well, Nat, I am in it with you, although on the other side. And that's really hard.
It is. Well, thank you, everyone, for sending in your questions. We hope that you've enjoyed this episode. And as a reminder, if you're listening right now thinking, why don't Sarah and Megan ever answer my questions? Maybe you haven't sent us one yet. So you can totally do that. And we really love to hear your voice. So go ahead and check out the show notes and there'll be more information there about how to send in a voicemail question, but we will take them via email too.
Yes, we will. And these have been some great ones that we've done today. So get those questions sent in and Happy New Year to everyone. We're so glad you've joined us. And that's whether this is like your first time listening to us or maybe your 357th time, however many episodes we've done.
Something like that.
We're just really happy to be kicking off a new year with you. And if you have a bunch of new year energy that you don't know what to do with, I have a great interview coming up this Friday with Sarah Hart Unger. She is one half of the Best of Both Worlds podcast. And she is a huge planner and planning and calendaring person, even more than me. So she has a bunch of tips for planners, getting a planner for the new year, but also using it the best that you can to have a super organized and productive new year. So I know that kind of thing is really fun to dig into this time of year. So that will be our first Voices interview of 2020. And that comes out this Friday. So we will talk to you then.